Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our exclusive interview with the French Admiral commanding Combined Task Force 50 in the Arabian Gulf. But first, joining us, as he regularly does, is my good friend Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners with a look at the week ahead. Byron, hope you had a great weekend, and thanks so much for joining us.
I did, Vago. They're never long enough, but good to be back.
Exactly. But hey, look, all right, skiing season is over, but sailing season is about to start. So what's not to like about that? Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. Byron, thanks so much for joining us on Friday, as you did on the roundtable. It was a great conversation, including a little bit of discussion on Adam Smith's comments to AEI. Our colleague Mackenzie Eaglin did a terrific job on that. We talked a little bit about F-35. I want to get to that in a minute because you put a thoughtful recap note on that. But for our audience, what's on your radar for this week?
Well, I think the first thing is obviously going to be President Biden's State of the Union address. Typically, defense doesn't figure prominently in these things unless there's really an ongoing national security crisis. I hope he makes some mention of national security and defense, but his primary objective is going to keep moving forward these two plans that one has been unveiled, the American Jobs Plan, and the next will be the American Families Plan. So within the context of, kind of broader set of where spending priorities are going to fall out, how's Congress going to deal with these? And I think equally importantly is, will the president send any kind of lines that he wants to see move forward? Where is he going to open some cracks for compromise on some of these issues? So it's not defense per se, but it's going to bear on defense.
And any anticipation in terms of what the president might say when it comes to national security and defense, aside from the fact that it's important for us to lead and, all the other rhetoric that the administration's been putting out?
Well, look, to the extent that he talks about broader foreign policy goals, U.S.-China, U.S.-Russia, Iran, that's really the framing concept for defense and national security. But he's not going to be saying anything about details of what he's hoping to see in the FY22 budget or his longer-term vision for the Department of Defense, force structure, major weapons programs. I mean, that's typically not at all what comes out in the State of the Union address.
I do certainly hope, though, that he talks about the urgency and the need for change and trade-offs, right? I mean, I think that would be something that would be very, very important to give certainly Secretary Austin and Dr. Hicks and the team at the Pentagon kind of an opportunity, given that apparently they are looking at a whole series of these trade-offs.
So that's a segue to an event that happens this Friday, the 30th, with Aspen Institute, where Kath Hicks and Jake Sullivan are going to be speaking. And to my knowledge, I think this is the first time that Hicks, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, will be speaking publicly. And the event is really the first 100 days of the Biden administration. It's going to be intriguing if she does say anything or gives any hints about where all these different reviews going on in the Department of Defense. How are they framing some of these things that are going to inform the FY23 defense budget?
And isn't that I don't want to sound like I'm lawyering for the administration, but isn't it both unusual and potentially meaningful that the Deputy Defense Secretary and the National Security Advisor are speaking together in an event like this?
I don't know how much of that is just the dynamics of the Aspen Institute and how much is, kind of a conscious plan. I don't have a view on that.
What are some of the other events that you're paying attention to over the course of the week?
Okay, well, I think Admiral Gilday is going to be speaking publicly on Tuesday. So again, anytime you get a Chief of Naval Operations talking, are there any hints about how he's thinking through the Navy in the FY22 and the FY23 budget, the POM that, you know, the building is now starting to work on. There's a Brookings event with Bob Hale, who's appeared on your show a number of occasions, former DOD comptroller, that really looks, it's kind of an arcane issue, but it's the PPBA budgeting process. And, you know, should that be explored or reexamined? There's been a lot of, I think, very thoughtful work that's been done on that. So that's another Michael Hanlon event. There's actually a little, it may be subtle. This is going to be a week that's dominated by the earnings reports of the major defense contractors. We had Lockheed Martin last week. This week is kind of the rest of the top tier of the U.S. sector. But there is going to be an IISS event on French defense innovation with Emmanuel Shiva that I think will be an intriguing kind of different perspective, because it's a different corporate slash innovation environment in France. They have a very good lab system. And I just think, you know, anytime you hear these different international perspectives, hopefully that'll help inform the U.S. debate.
It certainly is interesting. It will be interesting to hear a French perspective on that, as the French tend to be pretty strategic, not just in terms of foreign and national policy, but also industrial strategy, which is admirable. And I should point out the event with the CNO is at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and obviously a whole bunch of hearings going on the Navy Marine Corps budget, right? It's the House.
Yeah. Although that's the irony, Vaga, on the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee, you know, there's really no budget to talk about. Right. So kind of interesting framing, but, you know, I don't know how important that may be. There is going to be another Senate Armed Services hearing on April 28th on nuclear deterrence. So I think that'll be a broader framing event. You know, we've talked about this on your show in the past. I just think it's a discussion that's going to play out this year or next. I really don't worry about the ground-based strategic deterrent program from a budgetary standpoint this year or next, but there's going to be a debate about the triad and, you know, what should we be doing and in what size and what shape. And I think it's a healthy debate to have.
And give us the 30-second encapsulation. We talked a little bit about the F-35 program. You did a very, very thoughtful recap on events and sentiments. Give us your sense on what last week meant. Richard Abulafia and Ron Epstein on the podcast yesterday were, you know, not as confident that anything, you know, I mean, they thought not all that much changes despite this, given that, you know, as Richard put it, okay, we won't throw as much money at you. We won't throw as much extra money at you, but we'll still throw money at you. How do you, you know, what do you think some of the key?
Yeah, well, there's no plan B right now. I mean, I think the debate, you know, for the F-35 program is, you know, how many is the U.S. going to be buying? You know, I think there was a clear signal that, at least from HASC, they're not going to be adding to the DOD's request. So if the DOD requests 75, 80 F-35s, you know, what you see is what you get. And, you know, there's just this broader issue about, and it came out in the hearing too, pilots love the airplane, but it really does have some operational affordability issues. And that's going to ricochet, you know, not just through U.S. plans. The GAO testimony on the affordability gap is certainly fascinating, but it's also going to impact international demand for the program. And I think we are in yet another transition in how people are going to think through tactically or combat markets.
Byron, thanks very much. Ship Strike is going off behind you. Thanks very much for joining us. Look forward to having you back on again on Friday. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vago. Cheers.
And joining us now is French Navy Rear Admiral Marc Ossedat, the commander of the French Carrier Task Force 473 and Mission Clemenceau aboard the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle in the Arabian Gulf, who also commands Combined Task Force 50, the multinational naval presence in the region that includes the USS Eisenhower carrier battle group. His task force includes an air defense destroyer, two frigates, one French, the other Belgian, a replenishment ship, as well as a nuclear-powered attack submarine. We spoke with Admiral Ossedat via phone.
Admiral Ossedat, bienvenue, and thanks so very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Congratulations on what has been a very successful deployment so far. Almost 1 month into your command of Combined Task Force 50. What's the significance of French command of this important mission? And what are the key lessons learned from each of these opportunities? For example, the Clemenceau 19 mission was something very, very important in terms of interoperability lessons. What is the significance of the mission, but also the lessons that you're learning from it?
As you underline, it's not the first time we are deployed in this area. We had Clemenceau 19, which led us in the Indian Ocean, and now again Clemenceau 21. The big things of Clemenceau 21 is mainly to reinforce our trench disposal within the coalition inherent resolve of fight against terrorism. This is my core mission, and everything I'm doing, be it in CTF 473 or CTF 50, is leaning into this direction. My main things in addition to that, or in support to that, is my ability to survey, to monitor the air-sea space, and to reinforce our disposal, the French disposals, which are permanent. We have an airbase in the Middle East, and we also have some permanent means in the East Med, contributing to this to this mission. So I would say the first lesson learned is my ability, the ability of the French counterstrike group to dilute or to merge into this permanent and to be able to bring a complement of action, a complement which is possible through the means I have under my command. Of course, the aircraft, the 20 Rafale Marine, the two E2C Hawkeye aircraft, and all the assets which are escorting me, be it the French destroyer, air defense destroyer, anti-submarine warfare frigate, nuclear submarine I have with me, and also an Atlantic II, which is a maritime patrol aircraft. So all these means are very swiftly able to connect into this coalition network as we showed it in 2019, as we are showing it again this year. I would say the big game changer this year is to have taken the command of the Task Force 50 under the lead of the commander of the 5th Fleet, which has been a step. It's the second time we are taking this responsibility. Last time was in 2016, but we went a bit further this year, I would say much further in matter of integration. We started with the counterstrike group Eisenhower in a support situation of coordination. We were working alongside in matter of responsibility, and to one point we shifted to a more integrated way, where I was remaining the task for the chief of the task force 50. The French chaos strike group became the task group 50.1, and the U.S. chaos strike group Ike became the TG 50.2. So right. What we learned out of that was that a lot was linked to our ability to exchange, on one hand, on the combat information system, but also on the other hand, on the ability to pair our battle rhythm and to work together to produce a converging effect on our common action. So lesson learned of necessary link. I'm not talking. I have in mind, of course, the data link, which is tactical data link, which is very important. Also, the CIS, as I formally said, and at the end, the interoperability, which is what we are aiming for when we are working likewise. So that's much the big lesson I can draw.
The force there is to stabilize an unstable region. There are significant tensions, whether they're in Syria, in Iraq, deterring Iran, for example, and also being ready to be able to project force, even if it needs to get much farther to the region, for example, even Afghanistan. And obviously, nuclear negotiations are back on with Tehran. Has there been any change in the regional threat level from your perspective as the task force commander?
Once again, my action is mainly directed against terrorism and against Daesh. This is the first top mission. I have within Operation Inherent Resolve. I'm not aiming to anybody else. My action, of course, the presence of a Qaeda strike group is always. Has an effect of stabilization, I would say. Reminds us that when we are acting, we are in a way preserving our freedom of action where we are. And then what I can observe and my assessment is that wherever I've been since I left Toulon, be it in the Mediterranean Sea, be it in the Red Sea, Indian Ocean, and now in the Arabian Gulf, I don't seize any regain of regional threat level as far as I can observe it at the tactical level.
Let me take you to the question of interoperability. Obviously, that's a major challenge. Nations like France and the United States as well. You have a Belgian frigate that is also part of your formation. Has been very important. And obviously, you also interact with forces all across the Gulf region. Talk to us about what the keys are. You know, you also mentioned synchronizing battle rhythm. What are the key elements to making sure that you have that degree of seamless integration to maximize the effectiveness of your formation?
First, I would like to take a helicopter view on the subject of interoperability. On board the French Qaeda strike group, I asked my officers to wear two lenses goggles. On one eye, you would have the sovereign approach, where I want to be able to be autonomous in the way I observe, in the way I assess, I analyze and I assess the situation, and if necessary, the way I act. On the other lens is the matter of the interoperability, which is mandatory nowadays to produce effects, and I can barely imagine having such a deployment of 4 months without talking to anybody, so or working with anybody. So this is the two lobes of the brain we have always working in these two dimensions. This is the first point. So yes, interoperability is mandatory. The way we drive the French Qaeda strike group is always. Leaning towards the others, our partners, and I have a continuous bath, which I experienced 2 years ago, last year, and again this year, wherever in whichever fleet I am, U.S. fleet I am with, I'm working, be it the 6th fleet, the 5th fleet, or the 7th fleet. We work together. I'm very used to get into my escort, a U.S. destroyer. And of course, now as a CTF 50, it's the acme of in matter of interoperability. So we have this built-in habit to both explain the singularities and the specificities of the Qaeda strike group and the French Qaeda strike group, because we are a bit different in the way we do, even though there is a very high commonality of mindset of our officers, at least pilots and LSO are trained in the US. We have the same systems to drive the aircraft in matter of catapults, in matter of catching system, arresting gears, be it also the lands to help to deck on the aircraft carrier. So we have this I would say built-in interoperability with the US. At least we have the ground for this interoperability. We also have it with our European partners. You quoted the Belgian have during 7 weeks of this deployment, Leopold Premier, which is a Belgian frigate, which I had sufficient confidence to let her endorse some responsibility in matter of air defense and so on. When we were in the Med, we had a Greek frigate also with us. So this is a permanent mindset of being able to be interoperable. It mustn't hide the limits of this interoperability, which are, of course, the limits of the language. We have to be able to exchange. English is the medium, the common vehicle to exchange. So we have this first, I would say, both bridge between us, but also it can be sometimes a limitation. We have some different approaches in the way we work, having the U.S. Working much into a dynamic force employment, whereas we are in current situation, less, I would say, the dynamism is different. We have also some works, as I said, to pair our battle rhythm. We don't have exactly the same organization than the U.S. Carrier Strike Group, so we have to find and to match the effect which each organization is aiming at. So it means a lot of exchanges. We have different combat information systems. We have to find bridge, and we reached it, but we have to find bridge to have an exchange between these systems to be able to exchange chat with which we work, to exchange, of course, mail, files, and, of course, all the tactical data linked, which has to be exchanged in order to build a common operational, a comprehensive operational picture, allowing to give to the commander of the Fifth Fleet a wider view of what we are observing and what is our tactical assessment at our level. I have also to say that this interoperability is much helped by having me taking part of the every second day we have a meeting with all the other CTF, Commander of Task Force, and which gives me a very, I would say, a seamless position in this different task force organization. That's much what I can say about the key lessons in matter of interoperability.
Let me ask you about the F-35. A dozen nations are developing are acquiring the capability, including the United Arab Emirates in the Gulf. British forces are operating the aircraft, and the U.S. Navy is going to deploy with the jet soon. Obviously, has wrapped up all of its suitable carrier qualifications. The French Navy and the U.S. Navy have prided themselves on being able to seamlessly cross deck. As you said, you operate the E-2 Hawkeye, but F-18s can land as easily on the De Gaulle as Rafales can land on the Eisenhower. What are some of the things you're doing to prepare for operating the F-35? Are you guys doing any work? I know that later this year you're going to be in the United States. Is there any work you're going to be doing with F-35 integration and at least trying to do some cross-decking? Because it is a great capability and has a lot of intelligence gathering capability that would be valuable for, whether for an American task group or a French task group.
Yeah, well, in matter, I'm just turning back to the former question, just underlining that interoperability is mandatory. It's not an option. We have to be able to work together. And mainly we have in view of a common engagement or involvement into an operation, we won't have to discover that there are lacks or seams between the different jet aircraft. So it's something we are working on. I can't imagine tomorrow not to be able to have a common flight between F-35 and Rafale Marine. It's something we are working on. We have a roadmap on that to see what are the different level of integration we want to achieve to be fully interoperable, to be able to have a combined airstrike if necessary. When it comes to the technical aspect you were underlining, which have tactical effects, of course, about the cross-decking, we did that last year with the Ike when we were in the Med. We had the F-18 trapped on the and catapulted on the Charles de Gaulle and the Rafale, likewise on the Ike. It's something we are working on for the F-35. So far, it has not been done. And I would divert you in a way towards my DGA to know where is where are the studies for that.
Let me. You mentioned the DGA, which is the French legendary French Armaments Authority. Some of the world's best engineers and experts in military technology. The new generation carrier is under the early phases of discussion and development. Obviously, French Navy would like to look at the next generation after the Charles de Gaulle. What, from the standpoint of an operator, what are some of the characteristics you think would be necessary in a future French aircraft carrier?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would like to say, because it's a bit underpinned into your question, that we wouldn't be adapted to the current situation. So far, the carrier strike group and the our carrier vessel is permanently adapting to the threat, is permanently changing its composition. We are having some new batches, be it in the different assets, submarine, be it the frigates, be it the helicopter, be it the jet Rafale. All this is in a permanent upgrading behavior, meaning that for me, as a carrier strike group commander, I have, and it's the mindset of my staff, we are permanently adapting to this new environment and to the knowledge to use our assets. This is the first point. So I would say that it's much about tomorrow's threat that the evolution has to take into account. And if I had to draw very broadly, but I will speak on my perspective of a carrier strike group commander and not of a carrier vessel commander, which I'm not and I've never been so far, right, and I won't be. The first thing is that to my mind, we have to rebalance between power projection in the depth and the mastering of sea airspaces. We can't imagine being able to project power if we don't master the seas. So in matter of carrier strike group composition, assets, skills, tactics, it's much about being able to monitor and to master the sea to be able to go in depth for the projection of power. I would also speak about the ability to be the first into a theater, which is going to be more and more demanding in matter of A2AD. And what I'm experiencing day after day now is being identified through lesson we learn. It's lesson identified, lesson learned, and it's transformed into expectation for the next generation aircraft carrier, but for me, for the next generation carrier strike group, which I hope you understood is already being shaped nowadays.
Let me ask one last question, you know, because you raised sort of a strategic question about sea power. The British in their strategic review put the importance of sea power front and center, that a larger Royal Navy will be required. Britain is building, is finishing the second of its big deck aircraft carriers. Queen Elizabeth is about to start its first deployment that will go to Asia. Do you think that we're in a new era of sea power? And do all naval leaders have to do a better job to explain to their publics the role sea power plays, right? I mean, does the average French citizen fully understand the extraordinary capabilities France can bring to bear? Are we in a new sea power age? And are sailors and Navy leaders doing as good a job making the case for sea power as they should be?
Well, it's a very difficult question you're asking. And once again, I'm at the moment a tactician. I'm thinking at my tactical level. And what I can see as a big perspective, I would say, is that nowadays there is, from my perspective, I can see the effect I'm producing with the carrier strike group. The power it has, it's a huge political tool, a major political tool, and the range of option is very, very wide. And as far as I see, once again, these options are much solicited by, I would say, a shift where seas, I mean high seas, are bigger, are more and more. I would say there are space of freedom, space of liberty of action, but there's also space of contest, where we have to get the tools, and here is coming the sea power, to get the tools to maintain this freedom of action. And I think that the carrier strike group remains the best of it. It's not the only one. It has to be paired or to work in complementarity with other services, but in high seas, it remains a major asset. So are we doing enough? The chief of the French Navy recently published his view, his strategic view, about what should the Navy follow in matter of path, or where should the French Navy go in matter of perspective, through a plan which is called Mercator, acceleration, and which is drafting the mindset in which we have to be, which is also gathering the different means we have to develop in order to be able to have this sea power, to gain this this superiority at sea. So as far as I'm concerned, I would say that yes, the job is done, but it's never achieved. It's an ongoing process, as I explained you with the carrier strike group necessary update. It's much like at the level of Navy and at the level of forces, and especially at sea.
Sir, thanks so much for being so generous with your time.
Thank you very much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.